Oh man, I hate to do this. I wish Benjamin was late today. Just a couple minutes left in this track, but we got to go. Make way for too much information. The show regularly scheduled to show up in about 30 seconds. And it will. We've been listening to great, great track from Koi Pond. It's a trio, So Higher, the name of the LP. And the title translates roughly to, how do you say, Odyssey, let's say Odyssey, something like that. Oh, look at that. Oh, we got there. And my name's Scott. Thanks for listening today, everybody. You're tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide on the internet, WFMU.org. Please stay tuned. Too much information with Benjamin Walker is coming right up. We'll be right back.
I have technical questions.
Okay.
Like those Bruegel-like panoramas that you do with all that detail, do you take a lot of photos? I mean, because you do that artwork when you go home. You can't do that in the middle of that situation. So do you make sketches or take photos or what do you do?
I'm not a sketcher. I only sketch when I have to.
Okay, let me explain to you what's going on here.
Really. I do carry
the guy who just said
go,
he's not a sketcher, that's the cartoonist slash journalist Joe Sacco. He's being interviewed about his work on a stage at the University of Chicago. But the guy who just asked him that question, he's sitting in the front row of the audience. And it's not just some guy, it's Robert Crumb.
Because I always marvel at the authenticity of the detail in your stuff. It's just marvelous. So I just wonder how you get that. I'm sure some of it must be from memory.
There was practically no more engaged participant the entire weekend than Robert Crumb. You know, he kept chiming in from, you know, the front row.
That's Hilary Choot, a professor at the University of Chicago, the brains and the brute force behind this academic conference about comic books I attended last May. The official title was Comics, Philosophy and Practice, but most of the people I met just called it Hilary Con.
Okay, so there's a line.
Cartoonist
over here,
Dan so Clouse insisted that he gets the credit for coming up with that one. Yeah, Dan Clouse was there too. And at one point, he was on stage with Charles Burns, Chris Ware, and Seth.
I see another like jarring thematic overlap between all four of you.
It's not baldness.
Nice rug, Seth.
Hilary Choot did her best to get these four cartoonists to talk about their design sensibilities.
So will you guys talk to me about the book as object?
Somebody recently was asking me, you know, why aren't you excited to do web comics?
That's Dan Clown.
And I thought, you know, I'm not unexcited by the idea, just it's not my interest. And I was thinking, when I'm working on a book, I want to see that book and feel it, and that's the end result, you know, that's the thing that I'm waiting to get that box from the printer, which is always the most disappointing day of any cartoonist's life. Because it's never what you thought it was going to be. It's all, I have thrown many books out the window. Like when I first got just like, I just
literally
thrown
them out the window?
Yeah, there's like on Division Street.
Like on the lawn or the street, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I went through a whole box of eight balls out on Division Street, and then I realized like, oh, I'm not going to get any more of those. And so I was like out in the snow picking them up.
The guest list for Hilary Con just goes on and on. Aileen Kaminsky Crumb, Art Spiegelman, Francoise Mouly, Ben Catcher, Linda Berry, Justin Green, Alison Bechtel, Ivan Brunetti, Gary Panter. I mean, even if you know just a tiny bit about comics, you'll have recognized a few of these names. But if you're an unabashed comics nerd like myself, then your brain should be melting. Hilary, did anyone say no to you?
Everybody on my wish list came. Everybody said yes.
Now, I've been to my share of comics conventions, and over the past few years now, I've run into you at a bunch of them, like Angoulême in France and the Brooklyn Comics Festival here in New York. But this was the first comics academic conference I've ever heard of. Can you tell us what, for you, the difference between the two is?
Sure. So I got a wonderful thank you note from Ivan Brunetti a few days ago, and he said the reason this was so great for me is that there were no signings. He loved the fact that he didn't have to sit and sign books. You know, I think for the cartoonist, the fact that there was no signing made it a different kind of genre of event. Mm. It wasn't commercial.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the cartoonist Ivan Brunetti because you got the name for your conference from one of his books. But at one point, when he was on stage with Linda Berry, Gary Panter, and Robert Crumb, he seemed to go out of his way to suggest that you misread his title. What was that about?
So I got the name for the conference from Ivan Brunetti's book, which is called Comics, Philosophy, and Practice. And, you know, when I asked him if I could borrow his formulation, Philosophy and Practice, for the conference, he said, yes, I would be really honored, you know. But on stage, he said,
actually, the title, Philosophy and Practice, was meant to be a joke. It's kind of a parody of the whole University of Chicago. But like, that's supposed to sound overly dry. It's an oxymoron, you know, cartooning and philosophy. It's a multi-layered joke.
you know, it's a joke and it isn't. It's serious and it isn't. But I know it's not only a joke, and I know that for a fact because I've read that book and I've taught that book, and that is a philosophical book about comics.
Yeah. That, you know, there were actually a number of instances during your conference where it seemed that some of the cartoonists were sort of trying to have it both ways. They, on the one hand, they were happy to be on stage participating in this great event, but at the same time, they didn't want to fully engage. For example, there was an instance when you were talking with Alison Bechtel about her work, and you had a wonderful page from her book, Fun Home, up on the screen, a page in which she uses the panels to mark the passage of time. But when you tried to engage her in a discussion about the page, she flat out fought you.
Do I need to explain the picture? Oh, I don't really have anything interesting to say about it. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess I'll just end by asking then sort of what was the effect that you were going for with this image?
That.
That's Linda Barry, by the way, cheering in the audience. I was sitting next to her. And man, she went nuts. But I was really surprised to see Alison Bechtel fight you so much.
Yeah, you and I were surprised both. Yeah.
So what was going on with that?
You know, Alison and I are teaching a class together. That's a history and theory and practice of autobiography class. I mean, Alison and I can talk to each other for hours on end. And there's sort of no bigger egghead in the comics world, I think, than Alison Bechtel in terms of academic discourse, right? Her book is all about Winnicott and Lacan and psychoanalytic theory. So I think there was some sort of discomfort and nervousness with the event itself that actually, I don't know, led people to sort of
act out.
Well, you know, there was definitely that tension the whole weekend with cartoonists. It was sort of like performing a resistance to interpretation. And what's really interesting for me is that I kind of know it's not true in the sense that they actually are often quite interested in looking closely at their own work, right? So I think this was one of the things that was made the conference an actually interesting conference and not just a fun conference, you know, because it was a real tension to be reckoned with. So here I'm saying, oh, it's so great, an academic conference, no signing, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the other side of that is the awkwardness that surrounds an academic conference, you know, in which you're bringing cartoonists here in this academic setting that maybe makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah, but not everyone was uncomfortable. I mean, you did succeed in getting some of the most painfully shy people in the universe, like Chris Ware and Robert Crumb, to fully, you know, engage.
Crumb was the person who sent me a postcard saying, you know, okay, Hillary, I'll come to your comics conference. But remember, you know, we're not talking about global warming here. We're talking about comic books. And, you know, he wrote comic books in bold, big, you know, hand in this postcard. But then once he was here, he was participating and engaging the entire time, you know?
Yeah. One of my favorite moments was when Robert Crumb jumped all over Gary Panter when Gary professed his love for bad drawings and punk rock.
It was like start. That was the cool thing about punk rock. It was just get up there and do something, you know, start. And I like cruddy stuff, so that was another thing. I always liked bad drawing. And I grew up on the part of the 50s, was a lot of it was in Brownsville, Texas, on the border of Mexico. And bad Mexican wrestler print jobs also had a lot to do with, you know, off-register print jobs and things.
You liked off-register?
Yeah.
I struggled mightily to try and make everything register correctly in those color separations. No. Get those hippie printers to do it right and get the goddamn registration.
You know, I was staying at my friend John's house in the Loop, and he lives about a block from the hotel where you had put all the cartoonists. So I was able to hitch a ride on the bus that ferried everyone back and forth between the hotel and the campus.
It was like summer camp, the cartoonist summer camp bus.
Yeah, but since you all went to some fancy exclusive party on Saturday night, I had to find my own way. I think I sat there at the bus stop for like an hour. It was totally depressing. But then on Sunday morning, when I got on the cartoon bus to the campus, Robert Crumb turned to me and said that he had seen me the night before waiting at that bus stop. I guess the bus had driven by, and he said, I look like a sad, dejected loser.
He said sad, dejected loser?
Yeah, it was a fitting end to Hillary Clinton.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that. I wasn't on the bus that went away on Saturday night, so I'm sorry that happened.
Oh, I am not complaining. No. Quite the opposite. In fact, thank you very much, Hillary Chute, for putting on such an amazing event and for talking with me today.
Benjamin, it was so much fun to see you. I'm so glad you came.
Now, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know that comics are very important to me. And it's not just that I'm a loser fanboy. I actually believe that comics and radio have a lot in common. A cartoonist with just a blank piece of paper and some ink can bring an entire universe to life. A universe that is entirely his or her own. Cartoonists don't need film crews, set designers, actors. In order to create, they don't need other people. In fact, the cartoonist has total freedom. And the radioist has a similar freedom. Using the medium of sound, a radioist can create an entire universe that is entirely his or her own. I also believe cartoonists and radioists activate the imagination of their readers and listeners in similar ways. The reader has to use his or her imagination to fuse the words and pictures together and move from panel to panel. And the listener also has to use his or her imagination in order to feel and experience the stories and emotions. There was a point in my life where I would actually wander the streets thinking to myself, should I dedicate myself to comics or radio? And even though I couldn't draw, even though I hated the idea of spending all my time alone hunched over a drawing board, I loved comics just as much as I loved radio. And then one morning I woke up in some haze and I noticed in the newspaper that I shared a birthday with Howard Stern and Rush Limbaugh, and I took that as a sign that I should just be a radioist. And I think I made the right choice. Most days I think I made the right choice.
Why on earth would anybody devote themselves to doing comics? It's labor-intensive. You get a bad back. There's no glory in it. You tell somebody you're a comic book artist, it's like telling them you're a plumber. It doesn't get you the girls.
That's Art Spiegelman telling me exactly what I want to hear. This is June 2004, and I'm interviewing him at the Mocha Comics Festival in New York City. I'm actually on an assignment. It's like a dream assignment. I'm doing a piece on comics for National Public Radio. Well, something went wrong. Maybe I shouldn't have recorded 4 hours worth of interviews. Maybe it was just a topic too close to my heart in the first place. I'm still not sure exactly what happened. All I remember is waking up on an airplane.
This will be the longest flight in the world to go nonstop.
I'm on a press junket for the inaugural nonstop 16-hour flight from New York to Singapore, and I'm sitting in first class next to this guy who brings old people to Asia so that they can dress up as Santa Claus for little children. And he's talking my ear off. This is when it hit me that I'm probably not going to get that comic piece done.
I probably do 500,000 miles a year in actual flying. Not with bonuses, but actual flying. I mean, this is... I'm trying to think. I couldn't even count how many times I've been around the world and gone to Asia this year. I'm trying to think about it. Been around and done it all and seen it all from when it started. You're not recording all this.
No, I haven't. I'd like to turn it on. Okay.
Obviously, that is a whole other story. But I did end up dropping the ball on my comics piece for NPR. And for years, when I would run into some of the people I interviewed, like Art Spiegelman, Gary Panter, Kim Deitch, and Gary Garath, I would totally duck and hide. But when I was at HillaryCon, it struck me that I could take all those interviews out of the audio drawer and make something out of them. And 8 years later, finish what I started. And you know, it is true what they say. It's always better to finish what you start.
I remember going to the East Village Other when it first started, like it was about 1966, maybe.
Art Spiegelman again.
And I was about to go to college, and I looked at the first and second issue, and they had very bad comics in it. So I went and said, would you like to publish some of my comics? And Walter Boart, who was the editor at the time, was looking through it and goes, it's good, you got anything with some more sex and drugs in it?
In the 1960s, underground comics were championed by alternative newspapers like the East Village Other. But as Art Spiegelman learned, the editors wanted comics that would appeal first and foremost to their hippie readership. They wanted sex and drugs.
So I went to college to learn about sex and drugs and came back about a year later educated and went back to the East Village Other, by which time Spain Rodriguez, Kim Deitch had become part of their stable, so they were having much better comics, and Crumb had passed through. And I met Trina Robbins and became part of the East Village Other's cartooning. And there was already a network forming. There's this national network of subversive cartoonists. Not all of it being built around sex and drugs at all, but that was certainly part of its high profile. And what it really had to do with was a subculture had defined itself. People like me had come of age. I was one of the more junior members by being just 2 years younger, or 3 years younger, or 5 years younger than the other underground cartoonists I was meeting. But all of us had come of age liking comics, growing up with the last comics before the censorship of the Comics Code had set in, and had been indeed turned into juvenile delinquents, and were now young adult delinquents doing our own comics. And very quickly became apparent that the nerve center of all this was San Francisco. Time magazine or Life magazine would have these recruiting posters about how San Francisco is where you put flowers in your hair and ran naked through the streets. So bit by bit, the alternative cartoonists all ended up there.
As hard as it is to imagine Art Spiegelman living somewhere other than his beloved New York City, in the late 1960s, he told me, every aspiring cartoonist knew that the only place to be was San Francisco.
It was like being in Paris in the 1890s or 1910s. To me, it felt that way.
Buy yourself an underground ticket. Take the subway to the end of your mind.
There were the intellectual cartoonists. There were the pothead cartoonists. There were the beer-drinking cartoonists. There was the Zap crowd of the ruling monarchs, the best known of the cartoonists. And this managed to go on for quite a while until it sort of became overburdened with too much publication for too few distributors and readers, and the whole thing began to cave in on itself.
As I just mentioned, I'm not exactly sure what I was doing when I did these interviews. I think I wanted to explore the connections between the underground comics movement of the 1960s and 70s and the explosion of interest in comics that was taking place in 2004. This is when bookstores really started getting behind their graphic novel sections, and about the same time that the mini-comic scene peaked. Remember, in 2004, the internet had yet to ruin everything. So this history lesson I got from Art Spiegelman about the underground scene was extremely enlightening. Curiously, I also got to meet an actual child of the underground comics movement at this 2004 comics convention, Sophie Crumb. Her father, Robert Crumb, famously peddled Zap Comics out of a baby carriage on the streets of San Francisco, and now Sophie Crumb was pushing her own comic book at Mocha. She was very shy, though. She didn't even want to give me her last name.
You could just introduce yourself and tell me the title of your new comic.
My new comic?
Or just your comic.
Belly Button Comics.
Number
one. Sophie.
Even though she's shared a few experiences with her parents, Sophie told me that underground as a label doesn't work for her at all.
I've sold many small press stuff in the street too in Paris, not in a baby carriage, but in a basket. So it's the same, except that now there's more a variety of like different types of stuff. There's not even like a underground. The underground is kind of like dissolved into more personal, like individual range of interesting art. For me, what's interesting is just the personal honesty and witness of youth, or not even youth, of people living in this time, and like the truth and honesty and rawness and crudeness in comics. They don't even call it underground, it's more alternative now. Underground doesn't really even exist that much anymore.
I've never described myself as an underground or alternative comics under that umbrella, although I know that if I were at a family gathering and somebody said to me, hey, do you do those alternative comics? I'd say yes. But does it mean anything? I can't think of a better name, and I don't know anybody that really has.
Pretty much every cartoonist I spoke with at the 2004 MoCA convention told me that the labels underground and alternative no longer really apply to comics, including my friend Nick Bertozzi. He's the cartoonist who drew the artwork for the TMI show page, and when I spoke with him in 2004, he was writing and drawing his Cassavetes-esque story, Drop Ceiling. Back in the underground days, Nick told me, cartoonists did have to fight for their right to draw whatever they wanted to. But this freedom is now something cartoonists take for granted.
My dad used to read me Mr. Natural when I was a little kid, before I could read. And he would take out all the swear words, and he would, and I loved it. I didn't know what was going on, really. I didn't know what they were. These people were always smoking cigarettes, and they were always running around with their bare butts, and I just loved it. But so for me, the idea that there was a time where you couldn't do that, it's not a reality for me. So for me, the freedom comes with, I start at that basis with this freedom already, and I'm able to just. So for me, the comics I want to do, they're not even trying to break down any kind of taboos, other than maybe taboos that I have in myself.
Okay, so the most cliche story that journalists do about comics usually has a title that goes something like this. Bang, pow, comics aren't just for kids anymore. And this is a story that's been done hundreds of times. And around 2004, these kinds of stories were popping up with a sickening regularity. So I think one of the things I was trying to do with all these interviews was make a piece that could go something like, bang, pow, comics aren't for adults anymore. I know, it was a terrible idea. But really, it is true. One of the hallmarks of post-underground comics is their maturity.
As a medium gets older, it's sort of like what happens to a human being as they get older, like the same kind of process of, maturing happens.
That's Ivan Brunetti. In the late 1990s, he published one of the sickest and twisted comic books ever made. Sexual depravity and lurid suicidal fantasies on every page. A far cry from the serene, zen-like stories and New Yorker covers he's now known for.
There's just less nudity and rape or violence. I don't know. I'm not as angry as I was.
Ivan Brunetti told me that he believed the exploding popularity of comics was directly related to this maturing of the medium. Because freed from the expectations of being underground, cartoonists were able to explore the artistic potential of the medium itself.
It hasn't been about shocking people for a long time. It's just about creating stories that people would want to read, or just trying to capture, the texture of life, or just what it is to be alive on this planet. And even, you look at old, newspaper comics from the 20s and 30s, and there was a lot of dumb jokes and all that, but there were a lot of strips that were just about, daily life in those times. And, of course, they didn't have as much freedom as we have now to write about certain things. And I think we're kind of seeing, a combination of those trends, the way the newspaper strips were, and they just reflected what life was, and then a little bit of the sensibility of the undergrounds, in the sense that you don't have any restraints as far as content goes, and so we're moving toward getting a little closer to creating some kind of art form.
Okay, to be honest, it's clear that in 2004, Ivan Brunetti wasn't totally ready to call comics art.
It's not really up to at the level of literature, I don't think. But I think the best comics are about as good as the best movies.
It's interesting that the X-Men and Spider-Man are big movies now, because it shows me that films have actually declined to the point where the subject matter of mainstream comic books is a perfect match with the current state of film. because now films are very focused on pyrotechnics and like the special effects, basically. And this idea of serialized characters allows them to do 20 X-Men movies.
The Canadian cartoonist Seth is famous for the old-timiness that manifests itself in his comics and his wardrobe. But when I listen to this conversation we had in 2004, I'm struck by what a futurist he sounds like. Because he was right on the money about how ridiculous it was to think that crappy superhero movies would lead to more people reading comics.
Very few people are going to like see Spider-Man and rush out and buy a bunch of comics. They're just waiting for another Spider-Man film. And if they produce them fast enough, I suspect that the guys who even read the comics would just stop reading the comics and would just watch the movies. I don't really think those guys are fans of sequential narratives. They're attracted to Batman. They're not attracted to how comics are constructed.
For Seth, superhero comics don't even belong in the history of the medium. Well, at least the history book he would write.
I think the real thread of cartooning in the 20th century starts out with the newspaper strip cartoonists of the early 20th century, guys like Harriman and Winsor McCay, and those guys invented the form. Clearly, there's like stylistically and thematically, it's like the original cartoonist, the underground cartoonist, and then the cartoonist of today. And that seems to me to be the thread of cartooning. The stuff that happened with superhero comic books and all the stuff that happened in the 50s in the newspaper strips, that seems to be like where comics took a wrong turn that has nothing to do with personal expression.
Like Ivan Brunetti, Seth told me he believed the medium's newfound popularity was related to its maturing. But he also told me that the fierce dedication to self-expression with no compromise, that other hallmark of underground comics, was just as strong in cartoonists of his generation.
What's great about comics is that it's developed in a way that it's been below the radar, and people just did what they did, and there was no editors coming in to tell you what to do, nobody trying to censor you. There's certainly no big companies that were like worried about like whether you're going to offend this segment of the population or anything. I think we're really used to the idea that like we're doing this work purely because it's what we want to do, and there's never been any compromises. And there's always been an attitude of, what was the point of compromising? You know, it's not like I'd think like, oh, I'm going to turn off the three readers I've got. You just would like not care. You're doing this for yourself purely. And I don't think that's likely to change with anyone in my generation.
I think actually that the whole trajectory of comics parallels the trajectory of feminism really well.
In 2004, the cartoonist Megan Kelso was hard at work on her Artichoke Tales book, and she had just published an anthology of women cartoonists. She told me that the maturing of the underground, in a way, for her, mirrored the evolution of the feminist movement.
People talk about like the third wave of feminism that's going on right now, and I feel like comics kind of has its own third wave. Like the underground cartoonists like Crumb and all of that, they had these huge battles to fight. Like they had to establish themselves as independent artists with, you know, their own creative vision out of this very sort of genre hack kind of industry. And they were incredibly angry, and they had to kind of prove themselves, and they won some battles. So cartoonists of my generation, we came to comics where it was accepted as a storytelling medium that we could do whatever we wanted. We didn't really have to prove ourselves and fight in the same way. We just kind of got to use comics how we wanted to use them. And in regards to feminism, I feel like, you know, young feminists of today, it's not like there aren't battles to fight, but on the other hand, there are, you know, there are certain things about being a woman that are more sort of accepted and established, and we don't have to be like angry and proving ourselves all the time. So, yeah, I feel like it's kind of a really at a similar point.
I think when a medium has a history, it can go different places. I mean, obviously, what they did was necessary before we can do what we're doing. You know, we needed to stand on those shoulders. I think they freed us up, and then we didn't necessarily have to, you know, hit little buttons necessarily. So I'll always be glad for that kind of work. There's part of me that wishes I could be that outrageous, but I'm not. I'm just not that way.
In 2004, Joe Sacco was perhaps the best poster child for the arrival of comics as an artistic medium, because Joe Sacco was both a cartoonist and a journalist. He was, by definition, bi-label. but he was also a cartoonist with roots in the underground tradition.
Well, I think I started out with that aesthetic. I mean, my earlier work has more of an underground aesthetic, but I'm just interested in journalism, so I'm telling my stories in my particular way, but it definitely brings with it, I think, something that I got from those old undergrounds, which is just that you're free to do what you want. I mean, if you look at those old undergrounds, people like Crumb and Spain and all those guys were just doing what they wanted. It's not what I would want to do necessarily, but you just felt like they would freed their minds from something. And maybe that's the tradition I'm in. It's like even the way I tell my stories, I'm not necessarily beholden to old ways of telling those stories, because you realize this is a medium you can do what you want, you know, with, so why not?
I think right now what we have is an explosion of cartoonists doing what they want to do, really sort of expanding what the form is capable of.
That's Gary Groth, one of the publishers of Fantagraphics Books. He's published comics by Joe Sacco, Megan Kelso, Ivan Brunetti, Dan Clowes, Chris Ware, Robert Crumb, Sophie Crumb. He's one of the primary reasons we have a post-underground comics industry today. When I spoke to him in 2004, I wanted to get a sense of how he'd made it happen.
We started publishing the Comics Journal, which is a magazine about comics, in 1976, and we started publishing comics in 1982. And the first comic we published was Love and Rockets by the Hernandez brothers. And that more or less fell into my lap. It was sent to me for review in the Comics Journal, and I liked it so much I just offered to publish it for the Hernandez brothers. And they took me up on it, and then before I knew it, we were publishing comics. So none of this was really planned. I mean, especially back then, the independent or alternative comics publishing scene was very idiosyncratic and seat-of-the-pants kind of stuff. And the comic book market was just starting to form. The head shop market was collapsing. It was collapsing for a number of reasons. Part of it was the drug and paraphernalia laws that were enacted that put head shops out of business in the 70s. And part of it was just because underground comics were running out of steam. There was a glut on the market. Head shops, which were not particularly aesthetically discriminating, couldn't tell R. Crumb from, you know, some R. Crumb imitator. And so there was just tons and tons of these comics. And so that market was collapsing. And the specialty market devoted to comic book buyers specifically was starting to come into the fore in the mid-70s. And so what you had was this transitional period. And alternative comics, what we call alternative comics, which is sort of post-underground comics, took advantage of the comics market.
In the 1980s and 90s, Gary Groth's publications lined the shelves of these specialty shops. That's where I and thousands of other fanboys first discovered the works of Charles Burns, Dan Clowes, Chris Ware, the Hernandez brothers. But as Seth just said, really, the only thing these cartoonists had in common is that they were all good. And for Gary Groth, this is a key through line in the modern history of comics.
But, you know, when you look at the core group of underground cartoonists that came up from like 67 to 72, they were almost all good. They were almost all individual stylists. I mean, nobody copied anybody else. I mean, you had people, you know, from Vaughn Baudet to Gilbert Shelton to R. Crumb to Bill Griffith to Spain Rodriguez to S. Clay Wilson. And they had nothing, they didn't share anything except this kind of pig-headed need to express themselves unencumbered by editors and publishers. And I think the alternative comics from 1982 on, to at least say the mid-90s, when I think you might see a new generation coming up, I think they reflected the same ethos as the underground cartoonists. I mean, they're all individualized artists. You had Gilbert Hernandez and Jaime Hernandez, Pete Bagg, Dan Clowes, Chris Ware, Dave Cooper, Chester Brown, Julie Doucet, and I mean, just like the underground comics, every one of these guys were individual and equally good in their own ways. And, you know, what you've got now is, you know, just hundreds of kids wanting to draw comics, and...
Yeah, when I spoke to Gary Groth in 2004, he did admit to being worried about the growth of the cartoonist pool.
you know, the, I mean, the, I think there's always the danger that there's just so much stuff out there that, you know, there'll be a glut, and that readers who aren't real aficionados won't be able to tell the good from the bad, and they'll invariably pick up lousy stuff and generalize from that and just think, you know, comics really aren't very good anymore. I think there's a kind of gravitational pull to lowering standards in American culture. I mean, you know, you never raise standards towards excellence. I mean, standards are always sort of, you know, incrementally eroded. So I think you have to be very careful about what's the sheer volume of stuff that's coming out right now.
Okay, so it's been 8 years since this conversation. And if you don't count the taking of the publishing industry itself, there has yet to be a comics crash. The number of cartoonists working today in 2012 is truly mind-blowing. And while some are surely better than others, I'm not so sure I agree with Gary Groth. The creative freedom that cartoonists enjoy, this freedom to do anything and everything without compromise, hasn't diminished with the mainstreaming of comics. It's even stronger now. In fact, I'd say it's a freedom that inspires and gives strength to artists working in other mediums as well.
I've heard people say, you know, bill me as a former underground comic artist, you know, and to which I say, oh yeah, when did I become a former? I mean, you know.
Kim Deitch is a true original underground cartoonist. He was there from the beginning. And as Gary Groth would add, there was no one else like him. His most famous story is called Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Art Spiegelman published the first chapter in Raw Magazine, and then Pantheon Books put out the final graphic novel a few years ago. It's always the first book I gift to someone who wants to know more about comics. When he invited me over to his studio in 2004, he told me how the story began.
The way Boulevard started was like my brother and I were smoking pot one day and just kidding around, and we sort of worked up the beginning of that story, which was based on a true anecdote about the time that Max Fleischer threw a testimonial dinner for Winsor McCay around 1927, and that whole opening sequence of Boulevard picture McKay instead of Winsor Newton. It was him making a speech about the history of animation and losing his audience and then saying, and what McKay, there's different reports. I mean, it really happened because I've heard this story so many times. He just said, God damn it, the hell with all of you. You've taken my art and turned it into shit. And then he said one thing, which I should have left in Boulevard, which I didn't, was, bad luck to you, and sat down. I'm sure he said bad luck to you. And because a person wouldn't make that up somehow. It just sounds real. It has the ring of truth.
It was this interview that made me feel the most terrible about blowing off my comic story back in 2004, because Kim Deitch has a lot to say about underground comics and why this medium still matters today.
I think one of the great attractions of comics is that the overhead is low. If you can get your rent paid and you get a few inexpensive art supplies, you're basically in business. I mean, a computer might help for some research and stuff, but, you know, there you are. You're a cartoon studio, you know, if you've got the elbow grease to make it go. So that's an interesting trade-off of why I think comics is such a good medium, is there the potential for being able to do something personal with some artistic freedom is much more realizable in comics. You know, I think that is almost specifically why I went that way and didn't try to get into some aspect of commercial art or follow my father's footsteps into animation. I mean, all those seemed like pretty dull alternatives to me. I mean, even finishing art school seemed like a dull alternative. I just didn't see where the payoff was at the time. I had to get out and be in the real world a while to put these things together. I guess I had to sort of wait for... Obviously, there was this strange craving and feeling of dissatisfaction that was in the air in the late 1960s among a lot of sort of graphic art-oriented artists who all sort of came up with the notion at the same time that, you know, something interesting could be done with comics. It's sort of like, you know, it's like the Wright brothers invented the airplane, but if they'd f***ed up for a couple of months, Samuel Langley would have invented the airplane. It was in the air. And it's the same thing with underground comics. I mean, people were sort of getting that same creative idea all around the same time. That was one of the fabulous things about it. And one of the things that made you realize when it was happening that this probably was something real, because it wasn't. You know, I sort of feel like, yeah, I got the idea of underground comics, and I did. But so did a whole lot of other people. I must say, I mean, I feel utterly grateful that I came along when I did, you know, which was sort of, you know, underground comics, okay, some were good, some were bad, but, you know, it opened up comics in this amazing way, you know, where it was open season to experiment with the medium, it was open season to try to do something more interesting than just some kind of commercial schlock comics. It's uncanny, right from the giddy up, I kind of realized the real thing of value here was that there was a freedom to tell a lot of interesting and different kinds of stories. I mean, it's, you know, I kept thinking of that old Jules Pfeiffer thing he said in Great Comic Book Heroes, you know, the beauty of comics, movies on paper, you know, and I was really always thinking, yeah, movies on paper, because, like, you know, in my own world, like, if I could have, you know, chosen my moment of birth, I probably would have chosen to be born at the turn of the century, so that I would have been just about 20 when the movies got kicking out, you know, and movies were such a fly-by-night thing that anybody who had a camera and $500 could start making them, you know. Well, in a way, this is like, well, okay, this is sort of like that, you know. I pretty much had a vision of wanting to create some decent narrative work in the comics medium, and the only difference is in the attitude towards doing the work and the attitude of the process. I mean, I was a much more undisciplined fellow in 1969, somewhat more disciplined down the road, but the, you know, the basic desire, the basic vision, the basic notion of what I wanted to do in it has remained pretty constant. It's just that I've gotten better at being able to do it, you know, because I've improved my personal habits. So that's, you know, that's a major miraculous part of it. So not only has the whole medium gotten more excited, but I love doing this stuff better than just about anything you can name. It's my idea of a good time, sitting around doing it, which is a bloody good thing, because that's what I do most of the time.
Okay, I'm Françoise Moulet. I'm the art editor of The New Yorker, and we are in my office. And Benjamin, you're looking at my wall, yes, at my wall, and you laughed. But I wasn't there to watch your back. I really want to see what you left.
This is the greatest image in the universe.
Oh, okay. Well, I will not describe it because I really would like to publish this.
Really? So, this is publishable?
I think so, yes.
When I visited Françoise Moulet at her office at Condé Nast, I assumed all the cartoons on her wall were unpublishable, like the ones in her new book, Blown Covers, New Yorker covers you were never meant to see. But as she just said, she's hoping to get that one, the one that made me howl, out there. But well, I don't want to leave you hanging, my dear listener, so here we go. Imagine the leader of the free world in an Edvard Munch pose, wearing a hoodie. Actually, after closer inspection, only one image in Françoise Moulet's entire book, a drawing of a priest reading a Father's Day card with three uncomfortable little boys in his lap, strikes me as absolutely unpublishable. Many of the images, in fact, seem more like blown opportunities, like the one where a classic ballerina bends over, exposing her wardrobe malfunction.
That image was long before the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction, and had it been published, I think either Janet Jackson wouldn't have had a wardrobe malfunction, or she would have been accused of copying a New Yorker cover had she had one.
That one would have been so famous. I mean, you know that. I mean, that one would have been on posters. Like, that's all I'm trying to say.
But part of the pleasure, I think, is that it is in its own way a parody of the old-fashioned kind of New Yorker covers.
It works on so many levels.
Yes.
Now, the New Yorker's released a number of books over the past few years showcasing cartoons that didn't make the cut. But Blown Covers, Francoise told me, is an entirely different kind of book.
What I was trying to do is not to ask you as a reader to second-guess the decisions that we made or to show you things that were just as good, but actually I wanted to show you the process, because when you see what didn't work, what didn't run, what didn't get published, especially when you see sketches, when you see the enormous works that goes into refining ideas once they are found, and also searching for ideas, then you realize the phenomenal works that goes into this distilled result. I think the insight into that process of the artist looking for ideas is an insight into the creative process.
In her book, Francoise Mouly repeatedly says she's got one of the best jobs in the world. And it's hard to imagine a better one. Not only does she get to work with some amazing cartoonists, pretty much everyone you've heard from in this episode is in her stable, and she co-founded Raw Magazine with her husband Art Spiegelman back in the day, so she's totally mobbed up when it comes to cartoonists. And at The New Yorker, she doesn't even have to do meetings. She only has to answer to the magazine's editor-in-chief, currently David Remnick. It turns out that's the only way it works.
Fortunately for me, one of the things that make my job so thrilling and so exciting is that I only have one person to report to. And the one time I had to show the image to a number of other colleagues is because David was on a trip. So he was perfectly willing to go with that image, but he asked me to show it to my other colleagues, other editors, who are all word people, and they tend to try. So they all laughed. It was actually the image that I ended up putting on the cover of my book, of the Pope with his long robes is standing over a subway grating, and his robes are being lifted, and you see the dirty underwear of the higher-ups of the church. All of this was a visual metaphor that worked perfectly well, but when I showed it to word people, they started telling me that it did not work, and I was very surprised because they just laughed. So, of course it worked. I mean, and then they said, well, but the Pope has not anything to do with Marilyn Monroe. It's like, oh, come on. It's like, you know, humor doesn't work the same as logic. It actually, of course, the connection, and I had to give up, because once you start trying to rationalize why you're laughing and why you're being liberated to laugh, then it's, you lose it. I mean, you lose the power to appreciate the lightning bolt that the visual will give you.
Yeah. Let's talk about an image that's here on your desk that is one that was between you and David that didn't get published, that you talk about in the book. So this is like not by committee. What's going on here?
Okay, so this is a back in 2009, Robert Crumb had finished the Genesis book, and we were going to publish an excerpt of it in The New Yorker, and we did, actually, and it was a real event for us because we give it like 10 pages, which we don't give to too many comics. At the same time, I asked Robert to also do a cover for the magazine, and he's done a few, and they were very provocative. And here, the time of year was such, because it's June, I said, like, you know, one possible topic is weddings, and one of the things that's controversial, that's in the news, that is interesting these days, is gay weddings. So what he set out to draw is an image of a couple in front of a clerk at the marriage license bureau, and the clerk seems puzzled because in Robert's intention, it's not clear to the clerk whether they are man or woman. A woman is represented wearing a suit with an earring, and looking very mannish. There is a creature who presumably is a man, who has very muscular legs, on high heels, a skirt, a butt that sticks out, very muscular arms, tattooed, and looks like a very over-exaggerated caricature of a transvestite. When I looked at this with David Remnick, there was an hesitation, because we understood that the artist's intention was to mock those who opposed gay marriage. That was what he ostensibly wanted to do. And it felt that in trying to mock the opposition to this, it actually was giving ammunition to the opponents of gay marriage by presenting a gay couple as freaks.
Certainly free to, you know, accept it or reject it. You know, if there's, you know, you have some reason it's too lurid or whatever, it just, you know.
Francoise Mouly was one of the presenters at Hilary Chuth's academic conference in Chicago. And at one point, Robert Crumb joined her on stage and shared his views on this particular blown cover.
It was kind of unclear to me why it was rejected, so, you know, I kind of felt a little bit insulted because I didn't receive any clear explanation, so that's all. Just got it back in the mail one day. Nothing said about it, so. But whatever.
Well, now it's as published as it gets, because it has gotten to.
Oh, our time's up.
Whew. Francoise Mouly is obviously the most powerful person working in comics today.
It's the worst part of my job, but that is an editor's job, to reject, as well as to refine, as well as to ideally. It's for a better result, you know. It's like being a parent. You have to scold your kid. It's at least as important part of loving them.
But as fascinating as the rejection stories are, Francoise Mouly's Blown Covers is more a philosophical book about the power of magazine covers and the power of comics.
I think that as there's more and more of a flow of images digitally, you're now bombarded, anybody is, with like tens of thousands of images every day, most of which are trying to sell you something. It's a passion play in front of the cathedrals that is happening every day on your device, whether it's mobile or desktop and so on. And it gives even more importance to print, because print fossilizes, print stops it, you know, at that moment. And whatever we published last week, you know, is cannot be corrected or changed. And that is the best role that the artist can have, is and the best role that the magazine can have, is a kind of filter that will say, out of this miasma, here are a few things that are worth looking at.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Bang Pow, Comics Aren't for Losers Anymore. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, and Bill Bowen. It featured Hilary Chuth, Art Spiegelman, Sophie Crumb, Nick Bertozzi, Ivan Brunetti, Seth, Megan Kelso, Joe Sacco, Gary Groth, Francoise Mouly, and Kim Deitch. Special thanks to Susie Allen and Eric Fay at the University of Chicago for helping me with the HilaryCon audio, and to Gary Panter for showing me such a good time, and to all the cartoonists we heard from in this program. And special, special thanks to Tom Devlin for inspiring me to finish what I started in 2004. You can find links to all the work cited in this episode on the TMI playlist page, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that and more at WFMU.org.
WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. That was Too Much Information with Ben Walker. Stay tuned for Nardwuar.
Johnny plays jazz, Sandy plays the samba, Renee plays reggae,
Max plays the lava,
Fatty plays rock, and no one does finer. Who would think?
Nardwuar! Nardwuar! Nardwuar!
Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show. You just heard right there from Antibes, France, 1978, Geeker with Je Suis Punky. And today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show, an interview with, from Antibes, France, M83, Anthony Gonzalez. Plus, an interview with Willis Earl Beale from Chicago. In fact, we're going to begin with Willis Earl Beale right now on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show, then an interview with Willis Earl Beale, and then an interview with M83, all on the station known as WFMU. Here's Willis Earl Beale with Sambo Joe from the Rainbow.
Thank you.
I'll be standing by the street lamp, looking off into the night. When the haze descends, silence begins, and we smile while it's blue. Sambo Joe from the rainbow, emerge from the clouds so low. Pull me up from the river to the visceral sky tonight. Grandma turns on the fan while I'm floating on the ground. Stable bitches flash their teeth and bite me with love tonight. Fiery O's in my pockets, trying to find the way. Smoking happy on the bridge with the harp chords tonight. Sambo Joe from the rainbow, emerge from the clouds so low. Pull me up from the river to the visceral sky tonight. Telling tales of lust to the vagrants, slumber happy in the factories vacant, baking crazy in the upper room with oatmeal tonight. Sambo Joe from the rainbow, emerge from the clouds so low. Pull me up from the river